Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, resilience on radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, resilience on radio. Broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann. I'm with Thomas Wynne, who is a councillor and works in the media for the Cook Islands government. Thank you very much for joining me.
Me, Tucky. Nice to be here.
He's in Dunedin as the after-dinner speaker at the Otago Polytechnic Alumni Awards.
Yes.
And he tells me he's written a speech, because that's what he does.
That's correct. I've written my speech. I'm well prepared. Yes, I'm looking forward to tonight.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Ponsonby in Auckland. My mother migrated with my grandparents and family in the 1950s. We then moved to a suburb called Mount Albert and lived there most of our lives. And then in 2011, I moved to the Cook Islands, taking on a job as a counsellor at the local high school. I was the second ever counsellor there. So it was still a relatively new role, and people didn't really fully understand what the counsellor role was. But they do now.
Had you always had a strong connection to the Cook Islands?
Oh, yes. I identified as a Cook Islander very early in the piece. My mother's Cook Islander, my dad is from Dublin in Ireland, and they both are islanders. One's North Atlantic, one's a Pacific Islander. But I've always identified as a Cook Islander. It's the place that I've always called home.
Very much a shame that Shane's not here. He's from Dublin.
Ah, okay. I've been to Dublin too, but yeah.
So what did you want to be when you grew up?
A politician. That was pretty early in the piece. I wanted to... I wanted to serve and lead. That was really clear. And that was much to do with my grandparents, my mother, you know, the stuff around service to the community was really important to us. It's a value we hold and share.
As an expectation?
Yeah, as an expectation, yes. My grandmother's second husband was the founding member of the Cook Island Labour Party in Auckland. And when he died, Norman Kirk attended the funeral and presented my grandmother with a Bible that he inscribed. And so we've always had a very politicised family. Those sorts of discussions were very common amongst us. And I think the idea that we could be change makers was always a part of the conversation somewhere. My grandmother would always sit us down as grandchildren and say, right, who's going to be the lawyer? Who's going to be the doctor? But I think there was also an expectation that one of us may end up in the political sphere. That was always an expectation.
So were you prepared for that by robust discussion around the dinner table? What was the environment?
Yeah, no. My uncles were all watersiders, and they were all part of the trade union movement. And one of my uncles was also a founding member of the Polynesian Panthers in Auckland. And so this sort of discussion was always around. And I think I was, I know I was politicised when, or radicalised, I don't know if you can say that anymore, but I definitely understood power when the Springbok tour came to New Zealand. And I was 14 at the time, and I was in a school that was a rugby school, and everybody played rugby, and everybody supported mostly the All Blacks playing the Springboks, and I was this very small group of students that felt very strongly that it was wrong, and we marched around Eden Park at the time, and I saw for the first time what the police can do, what the state can do, how divided a country can become on certain topics. And I found my voice, I think, through that experience at 14, that even though it was a minority voice, I felt really deeply that it was wrong and that speaking up against it was right. And that really just continued from there.
You know, I think that the kids at the moment are having a similar experience with the school strike for climate.
I see the same sentiment, the same mobilization, the same sense of we must do something and we can do something. And even if adults, the adult generation, like some of them have said, are letting us down by their inactivity, we're going to do something. Yeah, I see the same thing.
So your desire to be a politician was as to create change?
Yeah, I think politician's really a dirty word. It's become a really sullied word. It's like calling yourself a Christian nowadays. People think of anything between Brian Tamaki, Israel Folau, and your local minister. I think leadership is really important, and service is very important. So to make change, I understood very clearly, very early in the piece, that if you're not at the decision-making table, then you cannot change anything. And I think protest, as necessary as it is, unless we can influence the decision-makers, we really just make a lot of noise. And that, to me, was ineffective. And so I wanted to be at the, you know, sit at the leadership table so we can make decisions that were impacted by, you know, my family's strong sense of service, because the two actually sit together. And I think with Jacinda Ardern, people, you know, whether you love her or loathe her, or have no opinion at all, this latest situation with Christchurch and the leadership she showed, and, you know, that sense of serving the community that was greatly affected by that, and the wider New Zealand community, resonated globally. And I think there's a growing expectation that leadership and service must sit together, and people will not tolerate leadership that's self-serving. And that, of course, you know, we have polar opposites around the world. I'm not going to name anybody, but, you know, names come to mind about self-serving leadership and the rhetoric that goes with that. And I think the appetite for that is becoming, well, I do hope it's becoming less and less.
So how did you get from your grandmother's table to, well, being a counsellor?
Look, I started working in schools in Auckland about 24 years ago and have stayed in that environment. And I was in that environment up until about 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. So, you know, one thing I understood was that you serve, and then when you've served and served well, the time and opportunity for being able to lead will come. And you just keep serving until that happens. And it's that whole idea of being faithful with what you've got in front of you and what's in your hands, and that something always comes of that.
That's a interesting, important observation, that you need to serve before you can lead. You can't just get out there and say, follow me.
No, not at all, because, you know, that we get autocratic leaders, we get, you know, dictatorships. You know, we have people that have a vertical view of leadership, as opposed to and making what's best for the people and the team, as opposed to what's making best for themselves. And we see it in religious settings, we see it in, you know, political settings, you know, people see it at the in the rugby clubs, you know, it happens everywhere. So service is absolutely essential before anything around leadership can ever happen, in my view. And when we've seen good leaders that have led well, regardless as to what sphere, generally that's because service has been a big part of their value base. And that's, you know, which leads into that whole other topic around values. You know, I think we are definitely making decisions more about around principled and value-based leadership, and we're looking for people that meet that criteria so that we can follow them. So those are people I can follow. I had a wonderful time with Helen Clark about 2 weeks ago in Rarotonga. She came up to speak at a Rotary event. I had a little bit of time with her by myself, and she said that, you know, she really clearly spoke about the fact that you must do what's in front of you and do that well. Don't worry about position. Don't worry about, wanting to be at the head of the table. That will come if you serve. And I think she's living proof of that.
You're working in schools. Can you spot a future leader?
Yes, you can. I can.
What are you looking for? What are we looking for?
Well, integrity is probably number one at the top, that they have integrity. And what that simply means is that they can make decisions based on values and principles that sometimes it will mean that their own personal need will not be met. And I think that's the litmus test, you know. When you're measured with something that you're going to lose personally from, but the greater good will gain, and you choose the greater good, then that's ethical and has integrity. And those things I do see. I mean, I can think of at least four or five young people in the Cook Islands that have come through our school system, gone through the scholarship system, and are working as graduates in the Cook Islands that I am absolutely certain will be leading our country at some stage. And I have a relationship with them because I like to ensure that happens, that they have the space to do exactly that. You know, often the cliche is, you know, young people are, you know, they're the leaders of our future. Well, actually, that's not quite true. I think they're actually the leaders of now. And that youth movement around climate change is demonstrating the fact that they don't want to wait till tomorrow. They want to affect the world right now. And I like the idea of giving them space to do that.
So what happened 4 years ago took you, I was going to say, back to the Cook Islands? Was it home?
No, 9 years ago.
9 years ago?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so a number of things happened. My brother had died, and we'd taken him back, his ashes, back to the Cook Islands, and something definitely shifted for me when we'd gone back, and I came back to New Zealand, and I just felt unsettled. And then my parents moved back to the Cook Islands, and then again we brought them back, and then again that sense of, you know, I guess it's, you know, those times in your life when you feel there's a shift happening. I definitely felt that shift happening. And, of course, once that starts to happen and you start looking for opportunity, those two meet somewhere. And that met with the opportunity to work in the high school there in the Cook Islands. And so that's how I ended up back home. Now, we say coming back, but I'd never lived there.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'd never grown up there. But when we speak to each other about when any of us that are born in New Zealand or born in Australia, wherever, when we come back to the Cook Islands, we speak of it as a returning home. You know, that when did you move back? You know, even though I'd never lived there, because I guess for us, we are always from there. You know, we may have physically left, but of course there's a part of us that retains itself there. And I remember, actually, it was 1999, first time I'd ever been to the Cook Islands. This place I'd identified with my whole life. First time I was there, 1999, and I remember when the plane dropped out of the clouds and I saw it for the first time, you know, there was just this overwhelming emotional experience that happened. You know, I cried. I really just couldn't stop it. Didn't really understand it, but my brother had arrived a week before me, and I caught up with him, you know, when I got there, and we were just sitting around having a beer together, and I said, hey, what was it like when you saw Raro for the first time? And he looked at me and he said, did you cry? And I said, yeah, I did. He goes, So did I. And we just both discussed this experience, you know. And, you know, it's hard to understand unless you've experienced it yourself. And you don't have to be Pacific to understand that. I know people that have been back to England or, you know, Europe, parts of Europe where their ancestors are from, and they've had that same epiphany experience. But for the first time in my life, I realized how Maori felt for New Zealand. First time ever. Why that hurts so much, you know, why, how that connection, you know, all of that stuff, it just became very real to me. And it was, there's another chapter just started, you know, in my life.
So can you give us a quick potted history of the Cook Islands?
Yeah, well, we, New Zealand Māori came from the Cook Islands, and we are from Tahiti, sort of northern Tahiti, the Marquesas area, Nukuhiwa, Nukuroa, those sort of islands around there. We call ourselves Māori, New Zealand Māori are Māori. We call ourselves Cook Island Māori. Tahitians are Mauhi. You know, the Hawaiians use the term Māori with an L. Kanaka Māori. Kanaka means tangata, same word. They use a K. We use a T. So we're Māori. We come from the nation of Māori, really. That's how I think about it. And Waka left from Rarotonga and other parts of what we now know as the Cook Islands and settled here in Aotearoa. We became a part of Great Britain, I think, about 1903. And there were a number of political things happening at the time. Our traditional leaders that were leading the country at the time felt that we needed to come under the rule of Britain. So we were annexed by proclamation to Great Britain. And then Great Britain, a couple of years later, actually thought to themselves, actually, the Cook Islands are of no benefit to us. We might just give them to New Zealand. And so we became annexed to New Zealand about 2 or 3 years later. And then the New Zealand government decided to call us the Cook Islands. We'd not actually been called the Cook Islands before that.
And what was it before that?
There wasn't a name. We were 15 or 13 islands that were individual, really, and had connection. But really, I think of the Cook Islands as 13 federated states that had their own identity, their own dialect, their own way of knowing, their own origin stories, but were connected in some way. So really the idea of nationhood really only really started once New Zealand drew a pencil map around us all and went, we might just call these guys the Cook Islands. We won't tell them, of course. We're not going to ask them for sure. But we'll call them the Cook Islands. And then my great-grandfather just woke up one day and somebody said, oh, by the way, you're a Cook Islander. So Cook came through the Cook Islands on two trips. He saw five of the islands. He put his feet on three of them and then made his way around the rest of the world. So he didn't do anything significant that, for me, that would give us any reason as to why we should be named after him. And it's been discussed, you know, somewhat over since 1994, where there was some idea around putting a Maori name back in for the Cook Islands, and that discussion's still happening. But
so it's now independent, but with some residual relationship to New Zealand.
So we have what they call we are a sovereign nation in free association with New Zealand. So for that reason, we are part of the realm of New Zealand. And over, you know, since that 1903 to now, the realm of New Zealand has meant different things. But under the current Labour government, they have this idea called the Pacific Reset, which is definitely renegotiating what that means for New Zealand and the Cook Islands, New Zealand and Niue, and New Zealand and Tokelau. So we're about to graduate as a country, OECD graduation, which is really huge. And I think we're stepping closer and closer to, you know, well, more and more away from New Zealand as such, as a colonial power, and more we are standing on our own, and also in this relationship, which is an interesting relationship, and one I think that we will just revisit and discuss and renegotiate, which happened with Norman Kirk. He wrote letters to our then Premier Albert Henry detailing this, and then Helen Clark did the same. In the 1990s, there was an exchange of letters, which, again, I can't remember what it was called now, but anyway, that relationship was discussed again, and it's still happening. You know, so next week, Jacinda will be over, Prime Minister, and there's a joint ministerial forum happening with our ministers and theirs, and, you know, this may well be discussed again, but... it's just a conversation that will keep happening until, I guess we'll just redefine what that looks like as our countries grow and change and develop. And I'm excited by that. You know, really am.
What is the economy of the Cook Islands?
Tourism's about, I think it's about 68% of our tourism GDP. We have about 167,000 tourists come through our country a year, which is about 2,500 a week, and is a huge part of our economy. We have very managed debt levels, so we aren't indebted to any country, especially one in the East. People ask me all the time about our relationship with China, and are we in trouble there? The answer to that is no. We've got a very good relationship with the Asian Development Bank and other funding agencies. But as far as our economy is concerned, it's very robust, it's very healthy. We have a very good standard of living, so much so that the OECD has said you're actually not a developing country anymore. You're actually developed, and we're about to graduate. That's a big thing that's happening. And that will mean certain funding streams are no longer available to us because we're developed. And we will need to look at other partnerships and relationships to help us to develop as a country. Because the reality is we are stuck in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And tourism is fickle. You know, one natural disaster could harm that income stream. And so there is talk around agriculture and other avenues to develop, but you know, there are other people that are talking about that. I guess these are just my observations, you know, someone that lives there and works there.
So you're carrying on your counselling work, working with young people?
Yes, I do that privately, yeah, contract work, yeah, for the Ministry of Education, and privately with private clients. Yeah.
What drives you with that?
Well, it's my skill set, and one that has been honed with the Capable New Zealand course here at Otago Polytechnic, of course, and I just love working with people. I just love being able to see them grow and change, and to be a small part of that journey with them is such a privilege. I really think of that as a sacred space where people grow, and Otago Polytechnic has become a part of that discussion now, because I'm a graduate student now and I'm doing the master's program, and it's given me access to something that I didn't have access to living in a small Pacific island in the middle of the ocean. And the course has been able to overcome any of those barriers, and I'm greatly excited by it. So much so we've got now 6 students in the Cook Islands that are doing the Otago program, Capable New Zealand program, and I'm actually facilitating 12 now that are doing the program, which I just love. You know, I'm now helping them as my facilitator helped me, and that's all part of the process. You know, that is so Māori in the way we see the world. It's so easy to step into because it's what we do anyway. The whole idea of Tuakana Taina, the whole idea of a big brother and little brother, big sister, little sister, the fact that we eat and then we nourish others is just the way we do what we do. For example, we've got a small high school of about 700 students in the Raro. We've got three, but that's the biggest one. And they have a fundraiser once every 2 years, fundraising for the school to meet certain needs. And each classroom just cooks food, and then they sell food. And they take about 3 or 4 days to prepare it all, and they sell it all in town. And one day, they raise $66,000. And that's a phenomenal amount of money.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. But the reason that happens is because every single person in Rarotonga gives. And that's just the way we understand things, that when it's your child, we will give, and when it's ours, you will give back to us as well. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, sometimes I think the island should just cave in on itself and just, you know, disappear. But, you know, we understand generosity and community more so, I think, because we have to depend on each other. You know, we are so interdependent. You can't have a falling out with people because you're going to see them every day. You're going to see them at the supermarket. You're going to see them at the petrol station. You're going to see them at church on a Sunday. And so we are forced to get on with people. We are forced to confront things where there may be a grievance, because you just can't exist. You know, you just can't, unless you want to hold it, of course, which then just becomes toxic. And of course, that does happen as well. But I've never understood community like I know it now, where I live.
What's the relationship between community and environment?
Huge. Yeah, very huge. In fact, that's become probably the cornerstone of conversations at the moment. So we understand the negative effects of 2,500 people visiting our shores every day, going to the bathroom, eating rubbish, you know, all of that, as well as our own local population. So there is a lot of discussion going on at the moment around sustainability. I mean, that's probably the key word is, you know, how are we going to sustain this? How are we going to manage this? What are we going to do with our rubbish? How do we protect our ocean? How do we protect our lagoons? How do we make sure our water's clean? You know, all those things. So, and government is a big part of that. So we've just had a rather major piece of legislation passed last year, which was the Marae Moana Act, which declared 50 nautical miles around every island as a no fishing zone, no commercial fishing, around every single one. And we've declared all 900,000 square miles of our ocean as a marine park, a spatial marine park.
Oh, wow.
With pockets of commercial fishing in it. So there are pockets of commercial fishing happening within that, but for the most part, it's protected. And we're about to, you know...
Because presumably, if you go there and you eat at a restaurant, you want to eat
fish. Yeah.
So, but you've worked out a system where that can still happen.
Oh yeah, so we've got local fishermen that fish, and they provide all the tuna and everything else for us, you know. Plus, we have commercial fishing going through our country, which has been there since the 70s. Now, the commercial fishing is what's the word? It's contentious, and contentious because, you know, there are parts of our community and environmental groups that are saying that it's not sustainable. And, of course, government has taken another position, and there's some tension there. And I don't know all the information. I can't really comment on that. But as far as sustainability is concerned, it's very much at the forefront of our minds. And especially so because if it's not sustainable, we die. That's the bottom line. We're not going to eat. If climate change isn't sustained, then we will disappear. You know, so we don't, it's not like we have a choice. Well, we do have a choice. We can just ignore it. But the negative effects of climate change and anything that's not sustainable, we can't escape. It's right in front of us. You know, it affects our daily lives. So in that respect, you know, we really are at the tip of the spear with regard to anything that can be done with climate change.
Are you seeing impacts of climate change already?
Well, we, you know, if you talk to certain people, they'll say that we're seeing the impact of purslane fishing, and that there's not fish there. As far as our lagoons are concerned, definitely too much of humanity being in the lagoon has affected the coral. That's an absolute definite. And if you go to the outer islands, like further north or further south, you see coral as it was, as opposed to Rarotonga, where, you know, it's mostly disappeared, mostly. Or it's been bleached, or it's dying, you know, and that's sad to see. So, yes.
It must be difficult to manage that message, because you still want people to come and visit beautiful Rarotonga.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Now, look, I mean, and right as we speak at this current time, you know, one of the tools we use traditionally around managing, you know, resource management was rahu, or in New Zealand Māori call it rahui. We call it ra'ui, and ra'ui was simply an area that was set aside where no one could fish or no one could go for a period of time until it had renewed itself. And so there is some discussion at the moment around ra'ui, around commercial operators in our lagoon, because they're there every day of the week. And I'm glad that that discussion started. It hasn't finished or arrived at anything, but we're definitely talking about it and thinking, what can we do to bring change traditionally and with the new tools we have, you know, the new science around that, the balance of the two.
How did you get from being a counsellor in schools to working in the media office of the government?
I was very fortunate that after working in the school for a short time, some of the stuff that was occurring, I was writing letters to the newspaper, and then after a while, the editor of the newspaper said, would you like a column? And so I've been writing a column for about the last 6 years. And in that column, just talking about some of the social issues, you know, sovereignty issues, you know, some of the things that I was either seeing in practice or hearing around formica tables. And I guess what basically happened was that writing in the paper on a regular basis segued me into an opportunity that was available working for government.
What do you write about?
In the column?
Mm.
Sovereignty is probably a big one. Just ideas around who we are as Cook Islanders. What does that mean? Talk some about our history, because our history isn't taught in school. And most people, actually, if you ask them, have no idea how we came to be called the Cook Islands. I talk about, you know, last week I was talking about sexual abuse in the Cook Islands and the need to speak up about those sorts of things. I speak about the jail that we have there. We've got 32 prisoners, and the way prisoners are treated in the jails. And, you know, look, I mean, I'm fortunate that I get, like I said, in my counselling job, I'm out talking with people and meeting people sometimes at the bottom end of their life. And these things really impact me, and the opportunity to advocate for them and speak through the newspaper about these things is really, really important. And it's, I consider it an absolute privilege, and not everybody agrees with me. I've had people stop me in the street and tell me, what a load of rubbish. Or they'll say to me, you know, you weren't born here, what do you know? And, I have opposition to some of those things. I've talked about the church there as well, which I belong to in the Cook Islands, and issues that I would like to see them champion more, which has had an interesting response from time to time. It's writing every week is a challenge, but I've managed to do it for nearly 6 years, and I really enjoy it. And sometimes it's just talking about something really wonderful that's happening, you know, the joy of being a grandfather, or my parents and stuff like that. Or one time it was on weight loss. So I needed to lose weight.
Put it in print, you have to do it.
Yeah, there we are. Help us make myself accountable. Yeah, so, yeah, it's a wonderful opportunity. And if I can write and capture things that people are thinking, and they stop me in the street and say, you know, that's exactly what I was thinking, I think that's just a huge privilege to capture and advocate for the voice of parts of our community, you know, huge. So that's how that happened. That's how one segued into the other one. And it's been a wonderful experience because, like I said to you, you know, leadership is important. It's either the answer or the problem. That's a definite from what I've seen. And to be able to work around the governance of our country and you know, the people there, and just to understand that machinery better, the mechanism better, is such a privilege. And I've learned so much about governance, managing people, and seeing how that happens, you know, seeing how it's done successfully. And I guess, you know, people sometimes ask me, you know, what's the overarching something you've learned more than anything else that you've, you know, being there? And my answer to that one is always the same, and it's power. I think if anybody wants to step into a leadership role, they need to do a 101 on power, because it's the most dangerous, toxic drug available to mankind. And it will turn people that had good intentions astray. It's very dangerous. I've seen it do things to people. Well, they've allowed it to do things to them that have turned them, unfortunately. And I'm not talking about my current government. I'm just talking about in general, you know. But it's, yeah, one thing that people need to consider, you know. Be it the captain of the rugby team, like I said, the guy that runs the soccer club. You know, we all anecdotally think about people that have been in a position that's had some power attached to it that became the bane of our lives, you know. And I think that, you know, they just didn't understand this very toxic, can be very toxic. Drug, I guess. I don't know what else to call it, really.
Is there an antidote?
Yes, there is, yeah. And the antidote to power is accountability. Yeah. People have asked me that question. They're like, you know, you want to get into a leadership role, you know, what's going to keep you from becoming like others, you know? And my answer to that is simple again. That's the simple answer is by being accountable. You have to be answerable to someone. There has to be someone that can speak into your life and tell you that you're being a prat and that you need to pull your head in. And generally that's your wife. You know, she's very good at that. And but I think in a professional at the professional level, you need someone professionally that can speak into your life, that you respect, that you will listen to. And I think that's hugely important. And it's when we find ourselves in a position where there is impunity, so dangerous, so very, very dangerous. So I have a couple of people that speak into my life professionally, and I see them on a regular basis, and they ask me the hard questions about things in my life, and I think that's important.
Have you found the sweet spot for your own making a difference?
Have I found the place where I can make a difference?
Mm.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, for sure. Well, counselling is part of that, you know, big time. And I'm a part of a number of NGOs on the island, that, you know, where we make a difference. I'm a part of the Rotary organisation where we make a difference. Advice, you know, advising people. I don't give advice in counselling, but often we're sitting around with others talking about, you know, sort of maybe some of the larger issues in our country, and, you know, just being able to speak to that has been good, you know. And that's really because of my vantage point in my current role. You know, it just gives me some scope. And I've worked interestingly, I've worked in two elections with two different political parties on the island, so I've had some breadth of experience in that. That was an interesting exercise, you know, working for the government and working with the opposition at one time. So,
is it the same message spun differently, or is it different messages?
I think fundamentally, you know, we don't really have like National and Labour, you know, or a sort of more socialist, more capitalist parties. I think fundamentally they're the same, similar, and we have nationalist governments. You know, we have policies that ensure or enshrine the rights of Cook Islanders in the public service, and we promote, you know, the our culture, our language, our views, our way of seeing the world in our constitution and in government. Though the way that maybe we do that would be different from the two different parties. Yeah, definitely.
Are you going to stand yourself?
That's the plan. Yeah, that's the plan. And so we've got an election in 2.5 years. So I'm definitely thinking about stepping into that breach then and putting my money where my mouth is. But timing is important, and I'm not, you know, I'm not 40. You know, I'm not a young man, so I've got a couple of shots at this, and that's it, really. And that whole situation is like that, just sits on the periphery. But like I said to you, all I know for me personally is not to aim at that, but to serve, and the rest will come. And that may be too vague for some people, but I just know that to be true for me. And I just need to do what I think is true, and the rest will take care of itself, because I've seen it happen.
Are you having fun?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no,
because you could see this sort of serving as being drudgery.
No, not at all. No. In fact, no. I consider an absolute privilege to do that. And service is, I don't know. It just, how do I describe that? I guess when you just think that people need to be valued and that people matter. And of course, you know, for myself, you know, there's a spiritual component, because I believe that people matter to God. I'm compelled to. Not only am I compelled to, the reward is so big. I couldn't outgive the need. You know, I don't want to sort of sound like sound a bit sanctimonious, but I just believe in pragmatic, practical, helping people, and that in itself is so rewarding, you know. I keep it simple.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I do. Sustainability is simply this, that my grandchildren, and I've got 6 of them, and number 7's on the way, that my grandchildren will be able to enjoy a better quality of life than the one I enjoy at the moment. And that's because of the decisions that we have made today to ensure their future. And when I see my grandkids, you know, those are the things that come to mind, and I think about them, you know, with what's happening in the Cook Islands and what I will leave behind and what they will inherit. And when they have the opportunity to put my generation through that measurement and matrix, I want them to come out the other side and say they did a good job. You know, they looked after it, they managed it, they cared, they took care of it. And you know, it's that whole idea, you know, the whole Maori concept of tiaki. You know, I don't own anything. You know, nothing is mine. I'm merely the caretaker of it. I'm merely the person that's been given this to look after, and then someone else will look after it after me. And I think as long as I understand that the ocean and climate and people and our community, our economy, tourism, all those things are mine to caretake and to look after, and then to pass on to someone else, then I have to ensure that that's in a good space or a good place when I pass that on, so that my grandkids will say thank you and not go, what a bloody mess you've left.
So we're writing a book of these conversations. We're appropriately calling it Tomorrow's Heroes.
Ah.
So when we look back and say, well, we're really pleased with the job that they were doing. Mm. They're our heroes. Mm. People object to the word hero, but we're going with it anyway.
Okay.
So you're in the mansion. Mm-hmm. Well done. What's the superpower that got you there?
Love. You know, I used to do this PD or professional development with our teachers. And I used to say to them, if those kids don't know you love them, they're not going to listen to a word you say. And when we think back at school and we think about the teachers that cared for us, they're the ones we remember. I mean, remember the ones that belted us as well. But the ones that really made a difference in our lives were the ones that cared. And not just cared, but they really did show love to us. And I think it's such a, you know, it cannot be underestimated, the power of being able to love and care for someone. And, you know, to me, that's the ultimate superpower, is that when you just care enough to do something, you know, you can say you love someone, but love has always been understood as an adjective when really it's a verb. You know, it's really understood and translated from human to human, not as an adjective that describes a feeling. It really is something that needs to be acted upon. And when we do, it's really the superpower that we were looking for. You know? How do we change the world? You know, so how do we change the world? I'm like, just do something. Just something. Whatever's in your hands right now, just do something with it. If, you know, it really is accessible to us. And, you know, the climate change, students going out and protesting climate change, they are demonstrating that they love this planet. They love it, and they want to do something about it. So rather than sitting in an armchair going, yeah, I love the world, they're like, no, actually, I need to do something.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Why is that?
Because I believe that nothing changes without activity. Sentiment, we'll leave that with the poets, but change happens with activity. And it's stepping out of what we know is comfortable into that uncomfortable space. And, you know, when I first moved into the role I'm in at the moment, one of our MPs, one of our ministers actually said to me, well, Tom, as long as you understand that if you can't handle the heat, then get out of the kitchen. And I don't like cliches. I find them just annoying. But that one has always stuck with me. And it is stepping out of our comfort zone, you know, and wanting to make change.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Definitely not my pay. We don't go to the Cook Islands to get rich, that's for sure. But and I say that because I think too often decisions made here in New Zealand or made in Western countries are based around finance or capital gain or my financial return. So the fact that we're devoid of that is actually such a shackle that we don't need to deal with. But what gets me out of bed every morning is the desire to be better. I've made plenty of mistakes. Real big ones sometimes too. And, you know, unfortunately, when we do make mistakes, we make mistakes with the people that we love the most. And anybody that's been a parent or a husband understands that, you know, our greatest successes happen there, and also our greatest failures. You know, I've always lived by getting out. The reason I need to get out of bed is because I need to be a better man. Yeah, and I need to do something to make that happen.
What is the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Well, I guess the biggest personal challenge is around leadership, yeah, for sure. And you know, being able to position, be positioned so that I can sit at the decision-making table with others, and how we can do that. That's a challenge. Wider than that, it's how to get the generation that's coming after me at that table, and for them to be able to share their ideas and to infuse their energy, which often people at my end of that spectrum don't have as much. And to be able to create a space where you know, we can share ideas, and, you know, again, thinking about how do we transition from where I am to the generation that's quickly coming after us. And I mean very quickly. So that's a challenge, is to be inclusive. Inclusivity in where I live, of course, you know, it's a very top-down sort of country, very horizontal kind of leadership. That doesn't always make space for people, you know. And I like making space. I think that's hugely important. My grandmother always said there's always room for one more at the table, and there's always a bed for someone else. And that stuck with me, you know, it really has. My mother was the same, and we lived the same. My wife and I did the same thing. And creating space at the table, I think, is important. And especially, if I can just add this, with people that disagree. I think that's important. You know, I don't want to be surrounded by people that agree with me. I don't want to be surrounded by people that we all think the same. And I think the challenge for us is to, you know, the challenge for all of us at the moment, globally, is to not be polarized. Because there's a lot of it going on. You know, when did it become them and us? You know, when did it become your that or this? Or if you follow that person, or you like that, I'm going to defriend you. In fact, where did that even come from? Why can't we sit around the table with shared ideas, differing views, but somewhere we can meet? You know, I think that's important. That's a big value for me.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur tomorrow morning, what would you have happen?
Our oceans wouldn't be in danger. Climate change wouldn't be necessary. The rubbish that we've accumulated on this planet would not be there. Equity, you'd see equity in societies. We wouldn't have the rich and the poor.
You're not going to be able to completely isolate yourselves from those global effects, but can you maintain a spot of paradise?
Well, you're right. I mean, those negative effects are happening by countries far larger than us, and we really advocate for our position because we are greatly affected by it. We don't contribute to it. Our carbon footprint is so small. But we are the ones that will feel it first. So, in that respect, you know, our current Prime Minister and the government have championed our cause like never before, and do it very, very well. And I'm grateful for that. And we just need to keep advocating. You know, we need to keep driving our agenda, and there is self-preservation attached to that. And there's nothing like self-preservation to get motivated. And we need to we need to just keep doing what we're doing. And fortunately, the UN and other global organizations are listening. That's really important.
Lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Yes, I do. If you've ever wanted to do it, do it. If you've never gone and got yourself qualified, jump on the Capable New Zealand website. I think it's amazing. It's an amazing course. And, you know, if you want to bring change and you're sitting there thinking things have to change, then just do something. Just connect with someone. And, you know, you'll be surprised at what can happen. Don't be spectators. We've got a world full of spectators. We want to be participators. We want to be people that participate in climate change action. We want to be participators in social justice. You know, we want to be participators in saying that when something is wrong, it's wrong. You know, we don't need the plethora of spectators that seem to be present at the moment and all on Facebook and all making comments.
You do have good leverage because at the UN, you've got as big a seat as...
We have no seat.
You have no seat?
No. No,
we don't. Well, we'll forget saying that then.
Yeah,
why
no.
not?
Well, when we have discussed this, the issue around not having a seat at the UN, the last time it was discussed in the 1990s, New Zealand clearly said to us, if you want a seat at the UN, then you lose your New Zealand citizenship.
Huh?
Yeah. So we don't have a seat.
You don't have a seat?
No.
Because I was going to say that, well, for the other small islands that do, they've got actually a voice that they need to use.
Yes, that's right. So we do, through UNESCO, through UNICEF, you know, through all the other UN subsidiary organisations that we belong to, we do have a voice, and there have been a number of times and situations where our Prime Minister and Prime Ministers have spoken at the UN about our cause, but we are not UN members. And that's an ongoing discussion.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Really appreciate being here.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lands Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. Each week we talk with somebody who is making a positive difference and try to understand what motivates them, what it means to see the world through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens is that of Thomas Wynne, a councillor and who works in media for the Cook Islands government. He's in Dunedin to speak at the Otago Polytechnic Alumni Awards. You can find Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and the full archive of podcasts is on sustainablelens.org, and it feeds through all of the poddy sorts of places. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go with podcasts and live streaming of premier local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.